Good morning. Oops, this is wobbly. I hope you're not wobbly. I hope you had a good night's sleep. It will be another beautiful day, another hot day, I think a little bit hotter than yesterday. But right now it's still shady. So my name is Klaus Müller. I'm the founder and chair of the Salzburg Global LGBT Forum, which we established in 2013 as a global space to advance LGBT human rights across the globe. And we now have 72 countries being part of this network with a great diversity of human rights leaders, activists, journalists, filmmakers, writers, politicians, diplomats, religious leaders. And some of them would be very interested to be part of this discussion today on archival geographies. And one of them is actually here, at least virtually, or through his work, which is Mohamed Royal. He has an exhibition at the very front on the LGBT, or especially the transgender and intersexual community in Bangladesh. So I encourage you to look at that, because he works really beyond cities in regions that are very difficult to access, and tries to document people there and also collect their stories. So that's very much at the beginning, a series of photos. So I will moderate today's session on archival geographies, big theme, documenting queer lives within and beyond cities. There will be five speakers, some of them in pairs. Each speaker, we agreed on that. We said, okay, each speaker has 10 minutes, but we kind of forced ourselves to be strict, to do 7 minutes for each presentation, and then we do a 10-minute discussion on the panel, because we want to bring down this super big theme of archival geographies to what is actually the work that our colleagues are doing. What are the lead questions? What are the challenges? What are the big opportunities? And then we are open for probably 30 minutes of Q&A, and if there's time, they will close down with a super thought that you can mump on over coffee. Good, so I will introduce them each before the presentation, because otherwise you will not remember who is who. But at least I want to say hello to Alison Oram, Matthew Cook, Pia Singer, Christoph Gürich, Scott Cowan, Bet Ashbury. Very glad that you're here, because you have been sick, so thank you for coming. And Clara Woppen and Marek Sancho-Höhne unfortunately can't be here, but you will represent the work. So without further ado, I would ask the two of you to talk about... And now I'll give you a bio line. So Matt is a social and cultural historian based at Birkbeck College in London. He has written histories of queer London, queer home and family life, and the AIDS crisis, and is currently working on what he's presenting together with Alison Oram on queer life beyond the capital, beyond London. And Alison Oram, let me get out of the way, is professor of social and cultural history at Leeds Beckett University, and has published a number of books and articles on the 20th century lesbian and queer history and on queer heritage. Good.
Thank you, Klaus. So this is the Alison and Matt double act. So this project is called Queer Beyond London, specifically because in the UK especially, London has compelled the historical gaze, and we wanted to see what was happening elsewhere. And in particular, we wanted to look at these four cities and see how geography, demographics, socioeconomics, and local identity affected experiences of queer life and dimensions of pride, which is what we're going to hone in on today.
And the sources we used in this project are the rich LGBTQ community archives, which each of the four cities has a huge depth of material, including dozens of oral histories. I mean, three of the four cities have had several queer history projects, so there's a lot of material in the archives collected since the 1980s. And so what we're doing that's new with this material is looking across at the different archives and comparing them one with another. which kind of raises a question about what do these, you know, what who uses these community archives, what is their afterlife?
So what we wanted to do is give you a really brief flavour of each city and what we think is distinct about it. So I'm going to kick off with Brighton, which is our resort town by the sea, 60 miles outside London, with a long-standing reputation for pleasure-seeking day trippers and dirty weekenders. It's got a service sector economy and has for a long time and relies on sole traders. And we think this is significant because it fosters a spirit, we think, of individualism. In the 60s, this was really elaborated. So the university arrived, the University of Sussex, a new arts festival arrived, counterculture flourished, and there was a growing ordinariness in difference and an often flamboyant and visible difference. And what we think is distinctive about Brighton Pride is that's what people talk about when they talk about being proud in Brighton.
So Plymouth is further west along the south coast, quite a long way further west, and it's completely different from Brighton. It's a military city, a naval city over centuries, a strong kind of military history. And homosexuality was illegal for both men and for women in the services until the year 2000 in the UK. So on the one hand, there's a very conservative, quite normative culture in the city. In many ways, it's quite a sort of isolated city, but important in the southwest. And so queer Plymouth citizens take pride, or at least they have done until very recently, in keeping their sexuality below the radar. As to use one of the many military metaphors that they do, but nevertheless, despite that, there was also a certain degree of tolerance of queer people. A lot of kind of queer crossover between gay and straight in the 1960s and 70s in the kind of backstreet pubs and bars. And I think the other thing to stress about Plymouth is the sense of community and the sense of familial belonging. People come back to Plymouth, their families live there, there is this sort of semi-acceptance even back in the 60s and 70s. So a strong sense of community and a very kind of cohesive LGBT community in Plymouth. Right, Leeds, whiz up to the north, into Yorkshire, to the north and to the east. So Leeds is a post-industrial city, quite a successful commercial city. And in many ways, Leeds is a kind of typical city of its type, you know, an important regional northern city. And so typical in the sense that back in the 60s into the 70s, it had lots of queer-friendly bars and pubs in the city centre, a bit rough. So, you know, quite a strong scene for men historically across the period. But what stands out for Leeds in terms of pride and politics is the radical edge that LGBT politics had in the city. Gay Liberation, GLF, was active there in the 1970s. And then from the late 70s right into the 1980s, there was a really strong lesbian feminist range of politics. Leeds led the way in a branch of lesbian feminism called revolutionary feminism, and in the actions around violence against women, so women against violence against women, and also in lesbian separatism. So Leeds in the early 80s was kind of where it was happening in terms of ideas. And that led, in terms of the LGBT scene, to quite a gender-segregated city in those years, right from the 70s through to the 1990s. And so sometimes it's a bit of a surprise to realise that, you know, by the end of the 90s, in Leeds, it starts to reflect again the rest of the country, and you find mixed lesbian and gay ballroom dancing as you do in many cities. So, you know, Leeds now is quite a city that has quite a sort of generic gay pride, but it has this really interesting radical history, especially in the middle of our period, 1960s through to the 2010s.
Alison, so Manchester. So Manchester recently, like Brighton, has its own queer draw. It's got this notoriety which has drawn queer people to it. But that's really something that we can see really since the late 80s, mid to late 80s. Brighton had that reputation, that draw, much earlier on, from the 50s at least. What's interesting about Manchester, or what's interesting to me about Manchester, is that there's a really, and has long been, a very tangible sense of local Mancunian identity, which is based in a radical and working class history, and a history of collectivism. In the 80s, it had an incredibly, well, it's long had a solid Labour-run local authority. And in the 80s, it absolutely paved the way, pushed the way with equalities measures. And that became woven into the idea of what it meant to be Mancunian. And so what I'd say about Manchester Pride is that it's about, Manchester Pride is about a binding together of civic, Mancunian and gay pride pulled together. So quite different, I think, from the texture of pride in Brighton, Plymouth and Leeds. And we'll stop there.
Munich Citizen Museum's collection appeal. Munich is looking for its LGBT history, and it's another pair of Pia Singer, who has an MA in sociology and gender, started to work at the City Museum in Munich as a freelancer, and now is a volunteer at the Urban Culture Collection. And Christoph Gürich has an MA in cultural studies and works also in the Urban Culture Collection of the Munich City Museums, and they're both the joint project managers of Munich probes into its LGBTI plus history.
I don't know if it gets any bigger, but maybe it's a certain enough.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's fine. Well, thank you for your introduction, and hi and welcome, everybody. We are very happy and pleased to be here today to present to you and afterwards also to discuss together with you our collection appeal, Munich probes into its LGBTI history. We both work for the Urban Cultures Collection of the City Museum in Munich. And over the past years, we changed our collecting policy and opened up our collection to more recent issues affecting Munich's diverse urban society. So now we feature themes such as migration, precarity, mobility, and also, and that's why we are here, LGBTIQ more prominently in the urban documentation and field of collecting. So together with the City Archive and the Association for Homosexualität, and there are also two members here today, we want to professionalize and establish the documentation of important events, places, happenings, and also personalities within and by the LGBTIQ communities in Munich. The Forum Homosexualität is an association for lesbians and gays in history and culture, which has already devoted its work to archive queer topics for the past 20 years and built a remarkable collection of objects and documents. But as a small association, they have to deal with limited space, limited money, and also limited paid staff. So it's difficult for them to collect and store bigger objects and also to preserve them for the future. So the City Archive and the City Museum can provide the needed infrastructures, but haven't defined queer history as an explicit collecting topic yet, and only possess fragmented archival objects and documents related to the LGBTIQ history, and also hasn't rewrite and queered their already existing collections yet. So we see working together as this typical win-win situation. Munich has a very broad, active, and vivid queer community, and it was also the first European city with a gay and lesbian electoral role, which was elected in the City Council in 1996. So in consequence of this early political establishment of LGBTIQ topics, various subsidized associations were founded besides the independent networks, groups, and collectives. And yet, the documentation of these diverse cultural and political activities in the same variety is still missing out. So to change that, we started our project just recently in March this year to create the Munich LGBTIQ communities. And therefore, we are looking for objects and items which can narrate, document, and visualize the queer history of Munich. So they can be preserved as a part of the city's material and written culture of remembrance.
So, but how do we do that, or how are we trying to do that? Our first step was to get in touch with the associations, networks, groups, and collectives to be able to understand the institutional network of the city and later to be able to document their work as well. We also try to get their support for the election appeal as advocacy groups for young and elderly, gay, lesbians, trans, and inter communities, which helped us to gain trust. Besides that, we are contacting individuals directly to widen our perspectives in one way, to interview them and also look for personal mementos and everyday items which are connected to the LGBTIQ history or presence in any sort of way. To communicate our appeal, we published leaflets, which we also have here. We can hand it out to you later. And used our project partners' mailing lists to distribute a web version of this leaflet, which you can also see behind in a different version. We printed ads in a Munich Pride Guide and another queer magazine. And there's further information for the project on our project partners' homepages and on the City Museum's homepage. We are planning a radio feature on the Munich Queer Radio Show, and there will be a short presentation on stage for the project on Munich's Pride. And just 2 days ago, we managed to produce a banner with 3.5 meters and 2 meters wide for the main stage of the Pride, which will be there this year in July, which we're really happy about. So in the end, we're using a combination of direct personal approaching and advertisement to establish our museum and the project partners as the central institutions for documenting and preserving Munich's LGBTIQ history. So this should be just a start to let everybody know that we are there for everybody to collect items and stories. We already got a lot of positive feedback from the institutions and people who showed us really their gratitude for this project and handed over personal mementos and documents. For example, I really want to rush through here. Oh, it's very small. nobody can see anything here. This is just a timeline out of our archival system, so I will give you just a short rush. That's a photo calendar of a feminist group out of the 70s, which called the Clitoris Group, which published this photo calendar for reinterpretate the female sex organs in a more positive way, which was very interesting, which was given to us from somebody who approached to us. Then here is a demonstration sign against the forced testing against HIV in Bavaria from 1985. I rushed through that. Maybe some local specialities. That's from a fetish club, MLC, which is one of the biggest in Germany. And you can see a drawing of Tom of Finland there with the Bavarian icons as well, and it's called the Lions Grube. So you see some local impact. I'm going to rush through here. I think it's kind of time to end because we want to have time for discussion. So, but what I wanted to say at the end, that we have noticed that after the mailings and that a lot of the material came, so but then we didn't force it more and more, it was getting less. So it takes some time to establish, and we're trying to manage it that we establish ourselves as a central institution, so we can collect the history of LGBTIQ communities as a self-evident part of Munich's history and culture. Thank you for your attention.
Scott Cowan is an information service librarian at the University of Windsor in Ontario, Canada. His research has focused on the information needs and access to information for the LGBTQ+ community. Scott, you talk about queer roots, preserving the LGBTQ2+ past and present in a rural Ontario county.
Thank you. So before I start, I wanted to first acknowledge that the University of Windsor, from where I come from, sits on the traditional territory of the Three Fires Confederacy of First Nations, which includes the Ojibwa, the Odawa, and the Potawatomi. I also recognize that in the scope of my presentation and what we're trying to achieve, that we are colonizers on Indigenous land in Canada. So the city of Windsor itself, just to give you some background, has a population of approximately 217,000 people, and surrounded by county, which kind of makes up a larger population, and is sort of isolated from the rest of Canada and the rest of Ontario. The closest city to us is 200 kilometers away. Our nearing county is Chatham-Kent, and then once you get to London, Ontario, that's where you kind of branch into larger cities and kind of branches from there in terms of urbanization. And many people in Windsor have constantly said that the 401 stops at London, the 401 being the highway that connects Windsor to the rest of Ontario. And in that, it has created a very isolated sense for people and in the county who feel more connected to the USA than they do to Canada. As you can see, we are literally right directly south of Detroit. And in doing so, when I first moved to Windsor in 2015, I noticed that most gay people would go to the USA to have a gay life in the USA and then come back to Canada and have their safe, secured, isolated life, in which they were quite happy to do. When I first moved there, I really wanted to get involved with the gay community or the queer community in Windsor, and I found it incredibly challenging because I couldn't find any information. The websites were sporadic or had lots of misinformation. They were really old, outdated. The really only option I had was to try and go on to like dating apps like Scruff or Grindr to try and meet people, but those are meant for other purposes other than networking or meeting friends and making a community. So what I wanted to do was trying to develop into something at first into like, how do I get this information? How do I lump it together? How do I find it? And I came across a really great quote that actually spoke to me, because that's how I myself kind of feel I integrated and got to know myself as a gay man. From Craig Lofton, that says, quote, "Some people go to gay bars to first immerse themselves in gay cultures, but I went to a gay archive instead. Learning about gay history probably helped me more than anything to accept my gayness." And for me, that really spoke to me to think, yes, that's exactly what I read stories. I went through and I read as much as I could about gay life and what it meant to be queer. So I gave a lot of talks on campus. A lot of my research has sort of focused on that area of building that culture and that community. And through that, I was approached by Dr. Renee Bondi in our Women's and Gender Studies department on campus, who wanted to build a new course for first-year students called Queer Activism. And so this course has helped introduce students to queer activism in Canada. And she had said, I like what you said. We want to do this. We want to make this more community. We want to build something stronger and deeper for this area because it is so isolated and people do feel so disconnected. How do we do that? And so together we came up with this idea of a digital archive or digital exhibit rather than a research paper. And so we've talked to students and we talked the idea of Wit Yao and how he talks about community archives, that they help a community find an expression of themselves. They help construct a community. They form the basis of community identity. They promote justice and reconciliation. They build and reinforce community memory. And they can gather all the stories and the minor narratives. And so both Dr. Bondi and myself realized that we can't tell the story of the community of the queer people in Windsor ourselves, and it wouldn't be appropriate for us to try and speak to all of those voices. So we started to develop this course, which I'll put a shameless plug that it was actually ranked as one of the cool courses in Maclean's magazine's ranking of universities in Canada. Granted, it is a sort of like pop culture magazine, or not pop culture, but it is a pop magazine, but we'll still take what we can get. So through doing this, we created this digital archive of queer life in southwestern Ontario. So we were able to bring in community members from outside of Windsor, or within Windsor and the county, who were trying to do things as well. We actually, the government has recognized that Windsor and the queer people in Windsor do suffer sort of more from isolation, and actually a nonprofit was given $500,000 to try and improve mental health and reduce isolation in the queer community in Windsor and surrounding area. So we knew that this was an issue, and so as people were trying to do things, we would bring them in to speak, and students were then asked to go and do their research on a place or space, is our first phase in this project, to look at places and spaces within the county or Windsor itself or the surrounding counties to gather that history and to tell those stories. Our second phase will hopefully be to gather people's physical story or people's stories of what it was like to grow up in the county and come out, but we're not quite there yet. And so through doing this, students have constantly said they've learned a lot. They've actually garnered a bit more history in terms of what it means to be queer themselves in this sort of post, like, it gets better era, and realizing that it's not actually their experiences aren't as everybody else's, and they've actually garnered a larger sense. We also have this as a rolling sort of project. Every year the course is offered, students will continue to contribute to it. But so far, because of the students we've had in class, we've been able to gather materials and things for a trans organization within the county, a service trying to provide services to youth, directed specifically at youth, high school GSAs that have been trying to, as they've come up, students have gone back to their high school to try and document what's happened and the histories in there. We've had one student delve into newspaper articles to document crime and homophobia within the county and within the area. We've also had a Two-Spirited student who started to start the page on Two-Spirited people within the county area. So this is far more than I could do on my own. So I've done a lot of work with Dr. Bondi. So just real quick, why students? We've tried to engage them in the community, push them past the traditional research paper. We recognize our own bias, just to say that we would be then gatekeepers of this archive, and we wouldn't be, you know, right, it's not our place to tell the stories or give the voices to the trans people, et cetera, in the community. So we want them to tell the stories as they see fit. So we're just providing the sort of means for them to tell their own stories. It also provides students as researchers, collaborators, historians, storytellers, archivists, and designers. And it's our hope that going forward we'll be able to help collect and gather the history of queer people in the area so that it will be available to anybody else and they will be able to kind of recognize, and anybody coming into Windsor or around the world will be able to see what we're doing. Thank you. Whew, sorry.
So I'm very happy to introduce Beth. Beth recently started working for the local government in the UK, but previously worked at the Pitt Rivers Museum, and she's most proud of running the Out in Oxford Trail project, which she thinks is the most important thing that she has done in her life. And that's what Beth is talking about. Out in Oxford, an LGBTQ plus trail of the University of Oxford's collections.
Hi everyone, thanks for coming. So, a bit of introduction to my project, an LGBTQ plus trail of the University of Oxford's collections. So the university, you might not know, has four different museums. The Ashmolean Museum, the Pitt Rivers Museum, where I used to work, the Museum of, it's just recently changed its name, the History of Science, and the Museum of Natural History, as well as the Bodleian Library, the Bate Collection of Musical Instruments, and the Botanic Gardens. So I'm really proud of this project because it was the first time all of those collections have got together and collaborated to produce something. It was also the first time those collections have done anything with LGBTQ plus communities. So it was a first for the university on two fronts. So the idea for the project came from a talk given by Professor Richard Parkinson in 2016 for LGBT History Month. And, well, you can see it at this link here if you're interested in watching it yourself. So Richard's background, he is an Egyptologist. He happens to be a gay man as well. He used to work at the British Museum, where he put together a trail of LGBTQ plus objects from that collection. And he also published a book called A Little Gay History, which I recommend. And Richard basically mentored me through the project. He was a fantastic advisor, and this book was largely a model for what we did. So the important thing, well, the key thing that he said during his talk that really got me thinking was that he advocated that public bodies make explicit rather than implicit provision for LGBTQ plus communities. In Britain, we have something called the Equality Act, and public institutions are supposed to help build relationships and promote equality between those who do and those who don't have what are called protected characteristics, including sex, sexuality, and gender. But often, a bit of lip service perhaps is paid towards those, and not many institutions really do take a public stance to try to promote equality. And Richard was saying that he hoped that eventually all museums would have at least one object on permanent display that was labelled as being relevant to LGBT history. I, at the time, was working at the Pitt Rivers Museum, which is a museum of archaeology and anthropology, and I thought, surely we must have something. We must. In all the thousands of objects that we have, we must have one thing. But the idea kind of snowballed, and we ended up not only having a booklet of a trail of items across all of the collections I mentioned earlier, but also a website. The booklet is downloadable from the website if you want a copy. I've discovered that some of my colleagues from the Pitt Rivers Museum also have a stand upstairs, so they may have a few of these left if you want one. The booklet is brilliant. We ended up down to the great work of several volunteers from the university, from Oxford Brookes University, which is also in Oxford, and from the city. A fantastic crowd of volunteers who identify as LGBTQI+, or as allies, who wrote interpretations of objects across the collections. And we ended up with 51 new interpretations of 35 different objects across those collections, with forewords written by Stephen Fry and by Richard Parkinson as well. The logo, the Q logo, was designed by members of a local LGBT youth group called My Normal, and I was really pleased to get them involved as well. I also managed to make connections with some other projects that were happening in the museums at the same time. So not only did we end up with a website and a booklet, but we also have a trail app and audio descriptions of the objects on the trail, again, written by the volunteers on the project, to help make the project accessible for blind and partially sighted people as well. We launched the trail in LGBT History Month 2017. Here's a picture of the Pitt Rivers Museum with some flags on top of the cases. One of my favourite images from the Museum of Natural History, Darwin with a rainbow flag. And also, this is the History of Science Museum. And the Ashmolean Museum also had some rainbow bunting on its gates, but it got stolen within a couple of days. One of these lovely flag cravats also got stolen, and I had to buy another one to replace them. It was very popular. So we had 5 launch events in the Pitt Rivers Museum, co-curated with the volunteers and local community groups, including a mini Pride parade led by Oxford Pride and a takeover event by My Normal, the local youth group. 445 people attended this event, which was amazing. The atmosphere was electric. The museum had never felt so fun. It was wonderful. So to very briefly introduce you to some of the contents of the trail. So we have an ancient Egyptian king, an ancient Egyptian god, several objects from the classical world, We also have Hermaphroditus, an intersex god from ancient Greece, Amazons. We have Hercules, represented, I thought, very cleverly through a celestial globe in the History of Science Museum. Similarly, an orrery to tell the story of Ganymede, the lover of Apollo. 1 minute! Okay, very quickly. Some royalty, including Queen Anne, who you might know from The Favourite, the film that came out at the beginning of the year. Some more gods. Japan represented, and if you're interested, the Pitt Rivers Museum stand upstairs has an example of one of these masks, if you want to have a look close up. And we have Africa represented, we have two spirit people represented, and this drum was actually commissioned especially for the trail. Artists, a musician, and an archaeologist. And wonderfully, Francis Turvel Peter, who collected these bone pendants, he was an openly gay archaeologist in between 1901 and 1941. He lived in Berlin in 1928-31 at the Hirschfeld Institute. And I'm very, very pleased to thank Martha Robinson Rhodes, who's speaking on Saturday, who wrote the interpretation on this chat. So we got, here's some more natural world. We were interviewed on BBC Radio Oxford, BBC South Today, and local TV, that's Oxfordshire TV, and some local newspapers. We were shortlisted for a Museums and Heritage Award, an Oxfordshire Charity and Volunteer Award, and Vice Chancellor's Diversity Award. One volunteer, Dr. Clara Barker, was given an award by the Prime Minister. We had a stand at Oxford Pride in 2017. The trail was used as a model for another trail that was launched last year about women in the university's collections. It was also the subject of a master's thesis. It featured in two PhDs, and Lois Stone will be speaking this afternoon, in fact. We've also given several talks and conference papers, and my normal, crucially, now meets at the museum once a month to have its regular meetings. Feedback has been amazingly positive and sometimes incredibly personal, and to know that I have helped someone come out is massive to me, and I don't even know who this is, so it gets me. The biggest outcome was the announcement in October last year that the museum has now been awarded £91,200 to continue the work of the project in a new project called Beyond the Binary. And again, if you pop upstairs, you can pick up a flyer about that project if you're interested in being involved. So 3 years on from Richard's talk, the museum's commitment to LGBTQ plus collecting is going from strength to strength, and I'm very grateful for everyone involved. So thank you very much for listening, and do have a look at the website.
Thank you, Beth. So Clara Wuppen has a master's. I'll let you first build up. There you go. So Clara Wuppen has a master's degree in the research of anti-Semitism from the TU Berlin, the University of Berlin. She's a free journalist and currently assistant of the project Invisible Lesbians, Gays and Trans in Mecklenburg-Western Pomerania, together with Marek, who can't be here. And Clara will talk about We Are Here, LGBTQ and T stories in Mecklenburg, Western Pomerania. Clara?
Thank you very much. So the head of the project sadly cannot be here today. Do you hear me? Yeah? Okay. But usually we also ask ourselves together how we can make queer lives and their stories visible that were and are always part of the rural area, but remain hidden in the gaze of the culture of dominance. We work at the organization Lula for Democracy in Mecklenburg-Western Pomerania, which fosters gender reflection and democracy promotion in this rural state. An important question of our work is, how is it possible to empower queer people and foster gender reflection in even small towns? And there's not just the obstacle of the ruralness of the area, but also it's rural in the territory of the former GDR, which means high unemployment, very poor infrastructure, and a constant feeling of being forgotten, also in telling history of queer organizations and lives in Germany. So in this presentation, I want to share some of our ideas and practices from the project, and I'm looking forward to our discussion. Since last year, we traveled with our exhibition, which you can see in the back. We are here, Lesbian, Gay and Trans between Hiddensee and Ludwigslust in Mecklenburg-Western Pomerania. In the exhibition, life stories of queer people in and from this rural region are told. You meet these individuals from the past and the present in form of life-sized wooden figures. The first female doctor in Germany, born in Sassnitz in 1843, shares the space with a gay farmer living under National Socialism in Wismar, and a trans painter from the present Greifswald. Further, there are some thematical foci, for example, on the LGBT people movement during GDR times in church circles. They are accompanied by audio and video material and chronological texts at the historical context on lesbian, gay, and trans lives in different epochs. Since this is a session on spaces and spaces beyond cities, let's begin with the venues of our exhibitions. We choose town halls, universities, and cultural centers to make queer their stories accessible in a rural area. You may come across it because you have an appointment at the town hall or you go to a course in the cultural center. We are present in small villages where there sometimes is no single queer organization or let alone any alternative infrastructure. And even if there is, it can happen that people just don't dare to enter these queer places in fear of being seen. Displaying queer history in the town hall thus gives them and everyone else the possibility of an unsuspicious peek into queer lives they would not have or dare otherwise. Even people who would never deliberately enter any queer exhibition end up in ours just because they have an appointment at the town hall, for example. So in the frame of a rural area, public spaces can facilitate the access to queer knowledge and a queer exhibition, we are arguing. It brings two surprises at once, the mere existence of queer people in someone's own rural area and their recognition by an official mainstream public space before there is even any community space. These surprises encourage everyone to rethink their knowledge of about their spatial and social environment. This process of facilitating access and rethinking knowledge continues on the level of the curated structure and the content in the exhibition. The visitor would approach the board on GDR history, which you can also see next, and expect what they know and repeatedly read about it. Instead, they find themselves reading about gay and lesbian perspectives to that time. It turns their knowledge about an epoch upside down and challenges mainstream narrations in history. Or they're just happy to find historical research on their small town, feel appreciated, and are already interested to read further. Then comes the lesbian, gay, or trans life story that they are now willing to read at all from a person that maybe just lived across the street 100 years ago. Oh, they also spent their holidays in Hiddensee. He was also a farmer, they might think. This very low-level offer of identifying with at least some aspects of the biographies of the wooden figures allows even those who may have been hesitating at the beginning to realize the ties between their lives. Lesbian, gay, and trans people suddenly feel very close, and they even live nearby. They are not only in Bohemian and faraway Berlin, they are here in the same place and have always been, the exhibition shows. The figures and the visitors share spaces and times. This is a silent but sometimes a very surprising moment for some visitors. It's maybe not provoking in a loud way, it doesn't revolt the dominant gaze, but it opens another important door, the willingness to see queer stories even from a perspective of the culture of dominance in a rural area and the ability to identify with them. Let's take a closer look on another effect these individual life stories have. The banner and title, We Are Here, implies common references and the mutual belonging of the people portrayed. Even though the different figures and info desks are gathered in a way of parading under the same banner, the exhibition does not focus simply on the movement stories and community spaces. Also, but not only because especially in the rural area, they are rare and as isolation is an important topic. Rather, the exhibition focuses, and this is also a relevant queer memory next to the history of movements and their heroines, on everyday life stories of survival, resistance, love, and isolation of individual, real people. What they share is that they defy gender roles and where and are therefore marginalized. They share the exhibition space, but they are not one. Their stories are highly differentiated by their spaces, times, individual circumstances, and political positions. Also, the life story of the first female doctor in Germany cannot only be narrated by her lesbian partnership. She was also a well-educated white woman, a feminist activist, the first female doctor. The exhibition thus acknowledges the intersectionality of queer lives by telling individual life stories. One last important aspect of the exhibition is how the lives of the people are told from an empowerment perspective. Instead of relying on the knowledge of the persecutors, we tell the story of survival, of love and support. We don't use the photo of perpetrators' files in order to not reproduce the pathologizing gaze and not to make this the only remaining information about someone. Instead, we use letters and to show the fight for freedom and rather and the person behind. So to sum up, the exhibition might miss at first glance the glitter or the high heels a lot of people expect in exhibitions on queer their stories. Got you. That does not mean that we normalize their story and squeeze them into history in our exhibition, though. Rather, we offer an identification with queer life stories and real people, and as such, retell regional history as their story. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I really am very thankful to everyone keeping time, because now we have our 10 minutes where we can kind of connect, because these are very different stories. And I think I would like to take one key that Beth mentioned, but I introduce it a little bit. So we work on very different, you also work on very different projects, all of you. In a way, you're coming from the outside, and you archivize, you document, you collect, you explore, you study. And you work with partners, heritage institutions, whose task it actually is to do that, and who have not done that. So you're coming from the outside into a heritage sector that has ceased to do its task, and who now might or might not be willing to change with your expertise. So the dirty question first, who pays the money in that? And, I mean, Beth gave the key with 91,000 British pounds now, but the projects that you have been running, who has paid for them? Is it coming from the heritage sector? Is it coming from somewhere else? And also, will these projects be funded to continue, or is it a one-time symbolic gesture by someone, and then you go home, and that's it.
Hello, is this on? Yep. when I ran the Out in Oxford project, my actual job was the assistant administrator for the museum. So I'm not a member of the LGBT community. I had no background in queer history or queer theory, so I went to Richard's lecture because my background is also Egyptology, and I like him. I thought it would be good to go and learn something. And when he said he would like all museums to have at least one LGBT object on display, I really thought, why are we not doing this already? It would be such an easy, simple thing to do that would make the museum immediately a more inclusive and LGBT-safe space. It seemed a bizarre that no one was doing it already. I don't think the museums were consciously ignoring the LGBT community, but I think perhaps because of the long history of, let's say, gay culture being underground because it was illegal for a long time, it was just not something the museums thought about actively collecting or talking about before. My plan was to try to find stories that were already there in objects that were already on permanent display.
But who paid for it?
Who paid for it? I'm getting to that.
Story, and
right.
It's a beautiful one.
Thank
who's
you.
Who's paying?
So, the university's museums are a part of a consortium, and they applied for money from a Quango, a government organisation called Arts Council England, to get funding to fund certain core posts within the collections. They made available small Kickstarter funds called Innovation Funds of £5,000. So I applied for one of these Innovation Funds. So I had £5,000. but I was only allowed to spend 10% of my time working on the project. And as more of the collections found out about the project and wanted to get involved, the project got bigger and bigger and bigger, and I had about 50 volunteers to manage 8 different collections. So as you can imagine, a lot of the project was done in my free time in the end. So I did have funding, but
This is one answer I was suspecting a little bit because of your enthusiasm. So there is a little bit government money, which are from the Arts Council, mm-hmm. and otherwise it's
volunteers.
It's volunteers. So the sector basically says, well, maybe, but you invest your time, your money, your resources, because it's not our task. How about you?
I mean, our research is funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council, but maybe the more interesting thing is the community history projects on which we based our research. So there was a big shift in heritage funding in the UK, history and heritage funding in the UK, around 2002, with more and more community groups funded by the Heritage Lottery Fund. In line with some of the other presentations, these pots of money were seen as kind of ways of instrumentally kind of forging community and connection. And so there was a number of HLF-funded LGBT history projects in our four cities that we've chosen, which is part of the reason we chose them, but also elsewhere. So there's been a kind of flowering because of that available funding. But of course, what that funding does is it shapes investigation, community history work in particular ways. And so there's a real difference in flavour between the HLF-funded projects of the last 15, 20 years and, say, the radical community-based projects of the 70s and early 80s in the UK, which were fired by a different form of activism. So the funding question is a really key one because I think it shapes the way in which history gets made and what gets collected and who gets interviewed. And so that question is kind of key to the shape of the projects that we've been looking at and comparing.
Can I jump in? Sorry. Yeah, for me, the more interesting question is also like, how do we get queer knowledge into museums and exhibitions? And we've seen several attempts here, or like, we have some queer, like independent queer exhibitions, which are like one closed entity, and then museums are trying to include, for your two projects, are including queer history, and I find it interesting, like the question of okay, is it an add-on to an existing exhibition, or shouldn't all the exhibitions be made up completely from scratch, or like how to integrate this, or is it easier maybe and more interesting to have just an independent queer exhibition but outside the mainstream museum?
Let's see.
So it still sounds what we are hearing, all the great work is basically driven by you. You get some government support, but it's not that the heritage institutions, also with you two, say, okay, so this is a priority, let's put in some money, create some jobs here, here's your budget, but they let you do it based on your enthusiasm. But there is very little money, I think, at this point in time. So it sounds heritage institutions open a door for enthusiasts to come in, but they don't put the money down because they say this is important for our identity as a heritage institution. I think that's also what I got from you, Scott. You created all of this.
Definitely. And I'd say part of that, I think, comes from understanding that I have a very privileged power, in a sense, as a hopefully soon to be tenured faculty member, that I have that academic freedom and those freedoms in my institution to say, we already have the existing structure, this is what I'm going to use it for. And knowing that nonprofits or general people in the community don't have those resources to go and say, use our resources to do what you want and tell your story. So rather than me doing it, it's me kind of using that privilege to let other people give their voice to it, I think. And so it's just kind of not manipulating, but it is kind of that like, hey, we have this, I'm going to use it this way. So,
I think in Britain we can see both those kind of tendencies. I mean, there's definitely, for the larger institutions, there's definitely that anxiety that things are just a one-off and that they depend on the particular management or particular networks of professionals within that museum or that heritage organisation. But the Heritage Lottery funding that Matt was just talking about has been quite extensive over quite a long period of time. And I was just trying to remember the figures. It's probably something like getting on for 120, 150 projects, separate projects over 15 years, and a million and something pounds. So you can look at that as glass half full, because it's ongoing funding, assuming that people apply for it, and there is a track record of it going to LGBT community groups. On the other hand, it's, if you look at the budget of the Heritage Lottery Fund as a whole, which is billions of pounds, it's still only a smallish fraction. So it's kind of good news at one level, and I think it's sort of underappreciated, which was part of what we wanted to use these resources, these archives, in our work and sort of bring them more to the light. You know, they usually go for a year or two. They do fantastic work in the local communities and often build websites and deposit their findings in local archives. But I suppose the question is, what then happens to that material? Is it known and utilised?
I think that would be my last question on the panel before we open to questions and answers, and also connecting to your question and what Clara just said. So you're all coming in a way from the outside, but you're cooperating with city museums, the government, archives, local communities, cities. Eventually you will step down, you will do something else, as people always do. Do you think that your expertise that you're bringing in is then implemented in the partner institution with whom you worked? Or do you think they have some we did it, so thank you and goodbye, now we can do something else? But there's really no race of expertise, there's no implementation in acquisition, exhibition, education, in these heritage institutions, because that would be, to say it nicely, a bummer. Because that would mean really nothing is changing. There is a one-time symbolic project that all these heritage institutions can say, you know, we did that in 2013, and then also in 2015. But then they really don't change their practice. Do you think they will change their practice because of your work?
Just to start off, I'd say sort of a yes and no to that, in the sense that the project that I'm working on specifically may not continue, but part of what we do with the students is we train them on how to, as best as you can with first year students, but on how to curate material, and then we talk to them about metadata and what that means, and we talk to them about how to digitize things, so they actually go through the process so that if they want to do something on their own, they can do it. And so while my project may or may not continue in itself on that exact same site, we're hoping that everybody that comes through and then is a part of it does learn those skills that, you know, say if they want to start their own WordPress site, then they have that idea of what is metadata, how does it work, how do we tell this story correctly, all of those things. So they sort of learn those skills to hopefully implement it themselves going forward.
The success of Out in Oxford is that the Pitt Rivers Museum now has also Heritage Lottery Fund money to continue kind of what I started with the Beyond the Binary project. And because that fund is so much larger than the Kickstarter fund that I had, the ambitions of Beyond the Binary are much bigger, and I think will have a lot of a more long-term impact on the museum and its behaviour. One of the outcomes of the Beyond the Binary project is going to be a one-off exhibition, but the museum's also starting to actively collect LGBT objects. So I think in time, the histories will be more prominent in the museum displays. So although my project was a one-off, and in a sense Beyond the Binary will be a one-off, it's a bigger thing now, and I think the museum will continue with that work.
I think especially in a rural region, it's a big disappointment for people if you just come by and then go back to your big city, because everyone moves away from their towns. They're having this experience all the time, and that's why they're these lone wolves kind of. I'm working at this political organization, and the exhibition is just one project, and we're always focusing on this area. So we will, even though we will maybe hand away the exhibition, there will be still projects in the region. So we are still in contact with the people, and in a rural area, these queer organizations are actually the people that are active there are also active in any other. That's the people. You can talk about it, you can talk with them about anything political, kind of. Because they're the responsibles for everything. So we keep the contacts, but the exhibition is just one part of it.
I will say something, but first you.
I guess really briefly. I think that a lot of the legacies of these projects are kind of intangible. I do believe that kind of one-off projects have their effects because of the people that see them and the institutional memories that they carry. But I think the broader thing I'd say is that I do think the range of stuff that's going on in museums, local authorities and so on in the UK and more broadly is incredible. And 20 years ago, there was none of this. So I think there has been lasting change that's partly come from one-off exhibitions and endeavours and projects that have begun to change the culture of museums, certainly in the UK, and heritage institutions. And that's partly, of course, backed up by the repeal of Clause 28, which forbade us from doing this stuff. But it's also out of new legislation from government on social inclusion, which has forced heritage institutions to think seriously about these things. And sometimes that's lip service, but sometimes those obligations are taken very seriously. And I think so it's begun to become inbuilt in the way in which museums and heritage organisations are thinking about these issues in the UK. So I don't think that it's quite right that you get a one-off project and it goes and that's it. I mean, of course, there's some tokenism, but I actually think there is a lasting effect and there is a kind of build, that is a set of building blocks that are moving us forward.
Well, I think you, and maybe, I think the key point what you made about the UK, there is legislation. So as a government museum, and if you're funded by government money, you need to adopt this legislation. You need to have inclusive policies, which is not the case in many other countries. And I think what we have seen in the heritage business is if heritage institutions are not forced by the outside to adapt, to really have very clear policies written within what they're doing, then it's very often tokenism and driven by enthusiasm. But enthusiasm is great, but it goes away, but it doesn't necessarily leave a big footstep. A footstep is when you ask a museum or an archive what are you collecting, and they rattle down the list and say, and LGBT-related artifacts. It's part of our policy, the way how we do. If you ask the education department and say, who is your target audience, and they say, youth, including minority youth and ethnic minorities and sexual minorities, then you know you're there. Because one thing, what many of you said, there is so much work, so we cannot do it. And the reason is, and that's why we do have heritage institutions, because you have professionals in heritage institutions who should do this work. And in kind of policy-driven, include LGBT history, include LGBT culture. The moment this is part of their job profile, if they get new into these positions, or if they get into their departments and they're informed what they are collecting, they will do so. And nothing, I think, is as helpful if a division says, this is what we do, and if we come from the outside, then they actually know. They actually have built up expertise.
Yeah, though I also think there's a broader cultural change. So even if you're not within, if you're not affected, if you're not included in the legislative umbrella, I think that there's been a shift in museology more broadly in archiving, such that even if you're not working for those museums and archives, it's on your radar as something that you should be thinking about. Even if inadequate.
I need to come to the UK then, because I don't see that in Central Europe. I see it in some parts of the US, but very often not. But what I have seen is the power of policy change. Like, and for me, to give a completely different example, if you talk to the foreign offices, diplomats, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, they would listen to your story, they had no clue. Now they know more, because the policy is that they need to report every single month on LGBT people and communities in all countries in which this foreign office is working. So they're sitting on so much information. When you come and want to enlighten them, they already know. So you suddenly talk to experts. And this is, I think, something that we want to have in the heritage business, that these are experts, these are professionals. They can't just depend on our enthusiasm. They need to do their job, because it is their job. Having said that, we're open for questions and answers, and we take three questions at a time. Two. Oh, where's our microphone assistant? And please, if you will, because we are such a large group, be brief and pointed in your question. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Hussein. My question is directly for Beth and indirectly for everyone. Because I believe the heritage you're exposing through this collection, these collections, is a human heritage. It's not just UK heritage. Were there any attempts or tentatives to make this content reach accessible or reach more communities? Like, for example, I saw some pieces from Egyptian heritage. Like, it would be amazing if Egyptians would know that in their history, some Egypt was once gay-friendly, and it can be, like, physically taken out the piece there or remotely, virtually. Like, for example, like, did you partner with any institutions to make it reachable? Just for information, in Wikipedia, we have a whole team working on GLAM projects where we partner with museums to give more visibility to their collections by creating articles about the pieces, translating them, and enriching them with photos that make them accessible even if you're not in the UK, for example, to visit the museum. So this is my question.
Thank you. Please.
Oh, no answer for that one.
we asked. We have three questions at the same time, and then we
answer. Okay. Terry Beswick, and I'm with the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco. And my question is really about the relative importance of having queer content in mainstream institutions versus queer content in queer-specific institutions. And in particular, I'm thinking about exhibitions in museums, and our organization and several others around the world are trying to create a full-scale queer history or culture museum, as we have here at the Schulz in Berlin. So I see the importance of both, but I'm just hoping people can speak to that question.
And then here is our third question. Thank you.
My name is Don McLeoding from the Archives in Toronto. I have a specific question for the City Museum in Munich. So there is an existing gay archive there already, and I wanted to know about your relationship with them, especially with acquisitions. Do you cooperate, or do you collaborate, or do you compete?
Thank you. So we have a question on the digital as a possibility to make the knowledge and the expertise that you're collecting through artifacts way more accessible, which of course is another demand on our time. Beth?
Because Richard Parkinson was keeping an eye on my progress with Out in Oxford, because he was very keen through the trail that he produced at the British Museum that as many different cultures and periods of time were represented, it was important for him to encourage me to do the same with Out in Oxford. So we tried very hard to make sure that... especially considering that the Pitt Rivers Museum is an anthropology and world archaeology museum with objects from all over the world, I think the only place, for some reason, that isn't represented is Luxembourg. I have no idea why. Someone just needs to go to Luxembourg for a long weekend and just collect something. But to have the most impact, I think, it's important to show that queer history is not modern and it's not just a Western European thing. That was an important point to make. And so to make sure that we had objects from other cultures, other religions, was important in Out in Oxford. Whether or not I can get those messages to the source communities, those objects came from, I'm not sure. I was very fortunate that there was an opportunity to make web pages of the project. So only, I think, 25 of the 51 interpretations that were written for Out in Oxford were published in the booklet, but all of the interpretations, all 51, can be found online. So do have a look at the website. So in theory, Out in Oxford is available internationally to anyone who has a connection to the internet, but I wouldn't know where to start to try to get that message out to Egypt, for example.
So it has not, with museum partnerships that you undoubtedly have with Egypt and other countries where your objects are coming from, that you inform them, we are going to reinterpret certain objects. Isn't that interesting? There has not been conversation about that.
No. So the objects that were chosen for the trail were mostly suggested by members of staff of those collections. So again, individuals who were enthusiastic about making the project work, they didn't necessarily represent the whole of the museum that they happened to be working in, but they were keen as individuals to be involved. And then the interpretations were largely written by volunteers from the community. Because of potential cultural sensitivities, I made sure that the staff members who had expertise within the museums for those particular cultures checked the interpretations just so that they wouldn't be potentially offensive to the source community they came from. But I also made sure that a member of the LGBT community read through all the interpretations too, considering that I consider the LGBTQ community to have been the source community for the project too. So I wanted to make sure that it was as inclusive and sensitive as possible. But I'm not aware of relationships existing already between museums in Oxford and abroad. There may be some since I was working there.
I think the question is future directed. I think this will happen. It's a great topic for international museum conferences. And of course, eventually it will come up in partnerships that museums and archives and heritage institutions have internationally. Are there anyone else to want to respond to that?
I was just thinking about the other question about mainstream organisations versus queer-specific ones, and I just wanted to say something, maybe it relates back to what we were saying before about permanence, that getting high-status mainstream organisations to embrace LGBTQ programming has been quite successful in Britain from the 2017 commemoration of partial decriminalisation. And the specific example I had in mind was the National Trust, which is not a state organisation, so it doesn't fall under the Equality Act. It's not obliged to do anything. But it's a mainstream, quite bourgeois charity, which looks after mainly historic houses. And they did a very interesting shift and pressurised originally by middle managers within that organisation, but took it on board and, you know, had a very interesting, important, successful series of events across at least 12 and I think probably more like 20 of their properties and a whole lot of other queer programming. And And I think that's really important because, you know, the households who belong to the National Trust, who are kind of, I don't know, the stereotype is that they're suburban, middle class, conservative, you know, to have the newsletter come through their door, you know, with queer heritage all over it, I think is really important. And in many of those properties, yes, it will be, okay, we did that for 2017, we don't have to think about that for another 10 years. But in other places, it has meant that their interpretation of the rooms and the people who used to live in those properties has been, you know, brought into their everyday interpretation. So I think it has had an important effect, and that's, you know, the higher status the organisation, you know, the more media attention and effect it has.
It's a lot of conversation necessary, which is good, which is good. I maybe want to add also to your question about mainstreaming queer content in mainstream institutions and saving the energy and build queer content in queer institutions and queer heritage institutions. And the question is also what happens when the two come together? And one example that happened in Berlin, the Gay Museum did develop a very large exhibition on homosexualities together with the German Historical Museum. But at least my opinion, what happened is the Gay Museum brought in all of its expertise. The exhibition took place at the German Historical Museum and at the Gay Museum, but the public perception was, wow, so the German Historical Museum is really doing a great job. And they didn't. Nothing changed for them once the exhibition was done. If you go through the permanent exhibition, you need a magnifier to find anything about LGBT. So it didn't leave any kind of implant because the institution basically treated the Gay Museum as a visitor. Now a visible visitor, not an invisible visitor, but once they were gone, and now it probably becomes a symbol. No, we did that. So I think it's also important for queer institutions who actually have way more expertise than mainstream heritage institutions, when they cooperate, to say, we would like you to also look at your collections. Where's your expertise? Where are the people in your staff who know stuff, who are willing to learn with us? Because we don't want to do this a one direction monologue. I was just wondering, I think as we have 3 minutes left, I'm not sure if we can have another question. If you do it in a 45-second comment.
Is there an opportunity for more involvement between the archives and activists? I was pretty impressed by the project in Pomerania where you went out to rural local authorities, some of them who may not have been willing to be challenged by LGBT stories. And I just wonder whether or not archivists are proactive enough in contacting activists and say, how can we make this material that we have on stories available to you that you can then disseminate in a way to challenge people who, you know, are not the ones who voluntarily come into the museums, or even make this information to younger people or closeted people who do not come across this material.
Clara?
I didn't mention this. The exhibition was also... like all the research was done also with students, together with students, and like in a participatory process. And I think right now I'm also like working on all the events and like the consequences that come of the exhibition. Like I'm working with the exhibition, not as much as I've been involved into researching on the exhibition. Now the main goal, like since last summer until the end of this year, is to work with activists, we do projects with schools, with classes. That's what we do with the knowledge that's portrayed. Like we show it to people, we do a lot of events with, we invite all the local infrastructure, really work with it.
Well, I want to give a big, big thank you to our colleagues who move us further, who also shared with us there are some positive developments where you think this might even be a structural change within the heritage industry. But we also heard that still a lot is based on enthusiasm, underfunding, self-exploitation, and still we have not made major steps in most heritage institutions, maybe in some, and maybe also with the success some heritage institutions, like the project Beth did, suddenly people join in. Success is always a good join-inner. But I certainly want to give you, please give our colleagues a warm round of applause for moving us further. And thank you for the audience. And now I think we all deserve coffee.